We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Good morning, and it's Friday. Today is the first day of August of 2014, and you're listening to a new program here on 1180 AM WFYL, We the People, Constitution Matters. Yeah, that was me with that very stalwart voice there in the narrative in the beginning, and of course I'm joined by my co-host,
Corinne Lillis.
And we have a new member to our contributors. Last week, we began our discussion in opening the program with an article that was written by Gary Porter, and we're going to continue that today on the, your choices, an article about choices and choices with the Constitution. Gary Porter is the Executive Director of the Constitutional Leadership Initiative, and we also were joined by our other contributor, Sam Rohr, former state legislator, now president of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network here in Pennsylvania. And we have our third contributor who's here in studio with us, and it's Charles Proctor of the Law Office of Proctor in Lindsay. And he was also representing Conestoga Wood Specialties in the joint case against the Kathleen Sebelius in Health and Human Services on what I call the Unaffordable Care Act regulation on mandating contraceptives. And he's in studio with us. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
And since a lot of our folks, I think, who listen to It's a New Day on a regular basis has heard you on the air with us, in studio and on the phone, and then when we did our constitutional roundtable at the beginning part of the year, you were an active part of that. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Chuck, for the folks out there who can get to know you.
Well, Bruce, in addition to having an active law practice, I'm an adjunct professor at Widener University School of Law, which keeps me hopping, of course. And I'm an allied attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom, and I work very closely with Randy Wenger at the Independence Law Center, which is the legal branch of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. And, of course, a lot of my focus is on helping churches, pastors, people with freedom of speech issues, freedom of religion issues, that type of thing. And right now, we see a lot of attacks on churches and people. In fact, one of the things, and we didn't have a chance to discuss this before we came on the air, but we're seeing a large increase in local municipalities trying to tax churches and their faith-based activities that don't occur on Sunday. And I just got an emergency call yesterday from someone, and we've been dealing with that, which is clearly not only unconstitutional, but violates a number of state and local laws, ordinances, and the like. So the attacks on churches, on freedom of speech, on freedom of religion continue irrespective of some of the gains that we have had, whether it's in the Supreme Court or in other courts.
Yeah, and that's outrageous, first of all. And this is also another reason why we're presenting this program to you, is that people have taken the Constitution and just taken it for granted. It's an old document. It's sitting in a case in a building in Washington, just another tourist stop. But it does matter. It matters to us, we the people. And you're going to get elected employees, such as what Chuck just talked about, that are going to do these type of acts because they think you're not watching. They think you don't know. Well, we're going to put an end to that.
I certainly hope so, Bruce. One of the things that I think that has happened in Washington is there's an arrogance that they know what's best for us.
Yeah.
They know what to do for us. They know how to take care of us, and what we call, the nanny state. And that's becoming more and more evident every day. And granted, we do need some governance in order to maintain 320 million people and our roads and highways and the like. But When it starts getting into your home and into your church and into the way you run your business and into the way you conduct yourself, I think we've got a real problem.
Yeah, and there might be some validity to the fact which just said that they think they need to take care of us, because in a lot of cases what we've seen with these, I don't call them politicians, I like calling them elected employees, with these elected employees, we've made some pretty bad employee choices here. And so there might be some validity to that too. But Chuck is now a part of our team, one of our contributors here. And, of course, on the phone is Gary Porter. Gary, good morning.
Good morning, Bruce. And Chuck, how are you?
Good. How are you, Gary?
And
great.
Go ahead.
I'm up in Plymouth, Massachusetts right now. We're taking part in a series of events put on by Plymouth Rock Foundation. So it's really invigorating to get back here and see where it all began with the Mayflower Compact in 1620.
Yeah, exactly. You're not standing on a rock, are you?
No. But I'll be down by Plymouth Rock later today.
Outstanding, outstanding. And, you know, going back, and that's one of the key things with understanding. Me being very much, as people will say, a history guy, to understand the past, the present, and you have to understand the past, where something came from. And to go to those original origins, Plymouth, go down to Jamestown, and where they stepped foot and began this country at and what they were thinking, that's the way to do it. That's the way to understand how things came about.
Exactly.
Now, you heard Chuck and I talking about the idea of our elected employees coming in. And last week we began talking to you in our introductory program about the article that you wrote called, it was your Constitution Corner, The Choice. And I'd like to pick up on that today. Later on in the show, we're going to be joined by Sam Rohr again, so we're going to have a full house of folks. And what I was looking at and reviewing it this morning is, of course, you're focusing a lot on the judicial system and things like that.
Yes.
Maybe if you could start things off talking in that direction.
Well, yes, we tend to place a lot of weight on the judiciary, and some of that is basically emphasis that the judiciary has placed upon themselves. You know, although Linda Holmes says the Constitution is what the judges say it is. Now, there's nowhere in the Constitution does it say that. That's his opinion. But we have taken that and run with it and just let the judiciary define the Constitution for us. Well, that's not the founder's view. And it's a choice. As I go back to the subject of the essay, it is a choice. It's a choice we make each day, mm-hmm. whether to study the Constitution, to understand it, or to go about our business and ignore it.
Yeah, and one thing that I also noticed, and there is a little statement that you put in here with Alexander Hamilton, of course, had different views on things, and was looking at who should interpret the Constitution. And it struck me, and Chuck, weigh in on this as well, it struck me the fact of interpret. Now, there's many different meanings of that word. For example, you have a language interpreter can do German to English or whatever. Or then you have a historic interpreter that's relating the stories and that of the past. But with the Constitution, as I believe most of us agree, it was written to a point where the average American, the farmer, the shopkeeper, could read this document, understand and comprehend what it meant. And we've gotten into interpreting things, and I think back to Bill Clinton and his, well, what does the meaning of it or whatever mean type of thing. And do you feel, either one of you gentlemen, feel that this thought of interpreting the Constitution has really set us on the track of the wacky with this document?
Bruce, if I could jump in for a minute. I think the word interpret is where we've headed, but historically, the founders and the courts used a better word, and that is an application of the Constitution to whatever particular law or issue is in front of them. Now, we've gone from application, which is applying the standards set in the Constitution to what's ever in front of them, to now let's let the judges think about it. And this semester at Widener, I'm going to be doing some work with some foreign students, and in preparing for that, I've been doing some reading. And in other countries, what happens is the judge goes back to his chambers, and he interprets, and he uses this book and that book and his own personal experience, and then he comes back out, and he makes a interpretation as opposed to an application of a document or a code or a set of laws. And that's where we're headed, because what we see in many courts is they're citing foreign jurisdictions.
Yeah.
They're citing foreign laws. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in the Constitution, I'd ask anybody to show it to me, where as a sovereign nation we have been asked or we've been directed to look to any other part of the world for our application of our laws.
Well, exactly, and I remember back to Arlen Specter that always used to quote his famous Scottish law, for example, on a number of things. But, you know, and again, going on what you were talking about, Chuck, is the fact that I've got a lot of friends that are attorneys, and I've always asked them the question, when you were in law school, what did you spend the most time on, constitutional law or case law? And they're always saying case law. And to me, that's like a doctor trying to diagnose something. Use case law as a point of reference to see if a previous thing was it, but not to look at case law and say, you got the same thing he has when you don't, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, Bruce, I'll give you an example. Being a professor, I'm familiar with what's going on in law schools, and a constitutional...
That's why I asked you.
a constitutional law class can be something as narrowly tailored as reading the congressional debates for the 14th Amendment. That's it. They forget that there's nothing else, with the assumption that the students have learned or understand or have some basic concept of the rest of the Constitution. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think law school is the place where whatever you learned in high school or middle school, which nowadays, of course, is very questionable, needs to be looked at very carefully. And we have our president today, who supposedly is a constitutional scholar. I don't see anything constitutional in what he does at all. In fact, I recently saw on TV where he's talking about he couldn't take his pen and write something and change a particular thing. This is back in 2011.
You know, what I also find interesting is all these people that are claiming to be constitutional scholars, you'd think they would all agree on the same points, but they don't.
It's, you know, if the Constitution were 2,000 pages like the Unaffordable Care Act, we might have some basis for debate. But the Constitution, if you look at how short and concise and simple it is, and that was derived from all the work our founding fathers did, it's not, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to read those words.
No. And Gary, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I brought this out in my essay. The Constitution, about 4,400 words, is pretty easy to understand, but you do have to open and read it, and that's what people are not doing today. They are assuming that their legislators and the judges will take care of this for them, that they have no personal responsibility to understand it. Well, that's just patently false.
Yeah.
But the Constitution today is not the 4,400-word document that the founders penned. It is today a 2,800-page document called the Constitution of the United States Analysis and Interpretation. As I pointed out, when a new representative or senator arrives at his desk for the first time, he's given a copy of this thing. This is about a 6-inch document. And this is the Constitution that is in operation today.
Well, in other words, you're saying that they have created a constitutional embellishment that is in effect for these hired employees, replacing the actual Constitution.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And somebody would look at this six-inch document and say, well, I could never understand that. And but the point is they don't have to. They only really need to understand the original Constitution as the founders penned it. Going back to debates, we mentioned the debates a moment ago. Well, James Madison's view was, as he said in a letter to Henry Lee in 1824, I entirely concur in the propriety of resorting to the sense in which the Constitution was accepted and ratified by the nation. In that sense alone, it is the legitimate Constitution. And if that is not the guide in expounding it, there may be no security for its faithful exercise. In other words, let's go back and see how the Constitution was debated in 1787, 1788, 1789. All those ratification debates are available to us. Let's go back and study those and see what they understood words and phrases and clauses to mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
all the information is there.
Yeah, you know, it sounds to me, being a retired government employee myself, and the government has, they're just wonderful people in justifying the unjustifiable, or in other words, in most cases, some of their jobs. And they'll take a simple thing as making an ice cube and try to rewrite the instructions and make it so complicated you need a PhD for it. And that's what it sounds like that they have done when Americans are just looking the other way or taking advantage of the fact that, yeah, it's the Constitution, it's just an old thing.
And going back to the choice is that people can ignore their responsibilities as citizens and leave that responsibility in the hands of representatives and people they haven't elected, or they can assume that responsibility for self-government, as James Madison said, and take it upon themselves to understand this document. It is not hard, and there's plenty of resources out there that will give you the founders' understanding of the document.
Well, you know, you just brought up a good point. I want both of you gentlemen to jump in on here is the fact that we not to say to change the Constitution, but maybe to talk a little bit about the accountability factor and so forth, is that we have in the House of Representatives, well, in Congress and the White House, we have individuals there that we hire through the election process to serve us, to preserve and protect this Constitution of the United States, but yet we leave rulings of it to individuals on a Supreme Court that are appointed, federal courts that are appointed, and the only real judges are your maybe some of your state and locals. Your thoughts on this?
Well, Bruce, one of the things that I think, and the Founding Fathers weren't looking at 50 states, 50 sovereign states,
right.
But in depending upon the state or the jurisdiction you're in, you may have a judge who's elected for a 10-year term. And then upon re-election, it's pretty much a given. You'd have to really go out of your way not to get re-elected. In other places, those judges are appointed. And I haven't studied every state, but I know that there are differences in the way that happens. Yet when you get to the federal and appellate levels, these are all appointments.
Right.
And so the political party that's in play at the particular time is affecting the decisions that we're seeing go to the Supreme Court.
Well, exactly. I mean, we see a lot of decisions that you look at nowadays, you go, well, these are made along political lines versus constitutional lines. And, of course, with the case that you were involved with, the ruling that came back, the numbers of those pro and against, it was outrageous. It was, of course, I'm a very conservative guy. You know, I tend to look at things the way I feel they should be looked at, and it was like unbelievable that it would have almost a split where it came down to a person on this thing, and when it was so clear.
Bruce, another aspect of this is we've allowed the judicial judgments to basically rewrite the law.
In other words, legislate from the bench.
Precisely. And the legislative function was supposed to be carried out by representatives of the people, not by unelected judges.
Mm-hmm.
So the legislative function, which is the key to the American Revolution, because the legislative function was being denied to them. governors were disbanding the legislatures in Massachusetts and Virginia, et cetera. The legislative function is key, and that legislative function is only to be carried out by the representatives of the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Gary, just a quick side note that historically a lot of people miss. And, of course, here in Pennsylvania, we're very fortunate being the what we call the birthplace of America, what have you, with the Constitutional Convention being in Philadelphia and that sort of thing. But to this day, we have something called Smith's Laws in Pennsylvania, which were enacted in 1715.
Okay, you got me on this one.
1715 that are still valid and used today, particularly regarding real property.
Well, how could that be? That's an old document. They don't mean anything anymore.
Bruce, we cite them all the time. And it just shows that the people had established systems of government to regulate their affairs. Even though King George was still, in 1715, I'm sure who was king, but they to regulate their affairs even prior to the Declaration of Independence. And what was the straw that broke the camel's back? His refusal to moderate the taxation situation. And that's what we're seeing today. The taxation situation is out of control. And people think, oh, I pay my income taxes. Well, you pay your income taxes, your state taxes, your local taxes, tax at the gas pump, sales tax at the store. It goes on and on and on, the taxes. And a lot of them are hidden. And people don't realize the total amount of taxes they pay. And that's why every year, you know, they have that whatever it is, that date in or the early spring where now you've paid your taxes for the year, the rest of the money is yours. Unfortunately, that's not really true. What you've got is a situation where that taxation is unending and burdensome at best. I think I'm being kind there when I say that, Bruce. I think you'd agree.
Very diplomatic. You know, I guess you have to do that when you're standing in front of the gentleman on the bench there and arguing the case, even though you don't like that guy.
It's always yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So. Bruce?
Yes.
Bruce, after the break, perhaps we could get into some strategies that people could use to begin to study the Constitution themselves.
Yes.
And hopefully find out just how easy that task is.
But I do want to, when we come back, hit you guys with a question concerning the choice in the Constitution and how it's being manipulated to control the people and that. So, Corinna.
Yeah, we are going to head to a commercial break right now, but we will be right back with more We the People, Constitution Matters, for a great second half hour of this segment.
Thanks for bearing with us on that one, folks.
Bruce, you're sure that wasn't the NSA?
It could be. It could be. Eric Holder's out in the parking lot looking at us kind of weird right now. So anyhow. But we are, you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And we are joined in studio here by Charles Proctor. And on phone right now is Gary Porter. And joining us in a little bit will be Sam Rohr. And we're talking about Constitution choice, legislating from the bench. You name it, we talk about it here. And I want to throw this out to both you gentlemen real quick, considering what we we're talking about in the last segment, and then get into the educating, how people can go about and educate. Looking at, of course, the Constitution, the way it was designed, allows Americans the freedom of liberty and choice. And, of course, that is now been and has been, I think, from the day it was ratified, started to be manipulated to the point where the choice of the people, well, it gets down to the fact where we elect these employees of ours to serve us, to represent us, but they have gotten into the realm of how can we use this document to control the people and direct them to do. And, of course, when we get the things like that, immediately in people's mind come the Unaffordable Care Act and the mandates and taxation used for punitive measures. And some folks will say, well, that's constitutional. The Supreme Court will say that. Well, as I always like to point out to people, the ruling of the Supreme Court said that portions of that law were constitutional portions of that law, not the whole thing. But, gentlemen, your thoughts on the fact and the way it's been manipulated, your choices have been limited by this government, and using the Constitution as a bit of a misinterpretive, let's use that word, ruse to control you. Gary?
Well, Alexander Hamilton in 1775 said, "A fondness for power is implanted in most men, and it is natural to abuse it when acquired." So it's not the onesie twosies representative. Every representative we send to Washington can be taken over by the fondness for power. So we as a people have to watch them. That's not what we do. We elect somebody, we send them to Washington, we say, "Do a good job, and we'll see you in 2 years or 6 years, whichever it is."
Mm-hmm.
We tend to ignore then what goes on in their chambers. But we can't afford that. We just can't afford that.
Right, right.
Men are not angels, and if they were, we wouldn't need government, as Madison fondly said. But they're not, and so we have to watch them diligently.
Well, as he also said, if we had angels, we would need government.
Right.
Gary, I think the other key issue here is too many of our citizens have just, in effect, abdicated that power to congressmen, senators, and other officials, and even judges, as opposed to getting involved, as opposed to reading the Constitution and going to the ballot box with that in mind. And by abdicating that power, by just giving it over and letting Congress do what they want, letting the Senate do what they want, that, I think, has led to this problem as well. And too many citizens are not well informed enough. And I think you'd agree with me that one of the places we need to start is in the schools. And I'm talking about even in elementary school, showing them the Constitution, showing them how government works. I spend too much time explaining to people, well, there are state courts and there are federal courts. There are courts of first impression and there are appellate courts, and this type of thing. And the people don't know what I'm talking about. And when I go around the country, I'm going to be in Nevada in September. They're having a religious freedom conference out there, and they're talking about forming a state family institute out there, possibly. I have to, pardon the expression, but I have to dumb it down what I'm talking about, these things, so that people understand the basic concept. And the refreshing part is when I am talking to people, and I keep it simple, I get a response. I see a light come on in their eyes. I see them say, "Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, you mean I could do this, or that's the way it works?"
Right.
And it's just that they have not been exposed to it, or they haven't taken the time to be exposed to it, a combination of the two. And
right.
I think you'd agree, we've got to change that culture.
And let me bring into the conversation a former legislator and president of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, Sam Rohr, is on the line with us. Sam, good morning.
Well, good morning. Good morning. It's great to be with you. I've been listening to the discussion for the last half hour. It's very good.
Good. And your thoughts, Sam, on what we've been talking about?
Well, you know, I just had a couple of thoughts that that came to my mind, and that's one that, you know, understand that most of those in office, and I would go as far as to say most, and I'll tell you why I say that, haven't really read the Constitution themselves. We had a debate on the floor of the Pennsylvania House some years ago. It was a big debate. And we had problems with people trying to understand the basics. And it wasn't me, but one of the other guys that was working with us asked on the floor, I said, "Wait a minute, I got a question here. How many in this body actually have physically sat down and read the entire Pennsylvania Constitution, let alone the U.S. Constitution?" There were about 10 hands went up.
Yeah, were you surprised?
Wow.
No, really not. You know, but that's exactly where we have gotten. So you have people who are there to fulfill the responsibilities and duties of the Constitution, but have never really read it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that goes into it, which is very, very, which ties back in, I think, to the whole mentality of where we are operating in a pragmatic postmodern society, where we've rejected or ejected absolute truth. Is the sense of the oath. The oath of office itself should be the binding covenant with the people as representatives. We said, the law was put into the hands of the representatives. That's where the lawmaking is to take place, and they take an oath. But yet, the oath seems not to mean anything, and we say, now, wait a minute. The oath ought to be the binding component. Well, it ought to be. But the oath and the taking of the oath depends upon whether or not the person is a person of integrity where truth means anything. When we've gotten to a point, and you had conversation earlier about the president or others who can seem to go at will, and you say, how can that happen? Well, it happens because we've moved into a concept that there is no such thing as absolute truth. Truth is what you may need to make it to be, and it can vary. So if it's convenient to ignore the oath or ignore what it stands for, the Constitution, and do something else because it sounds right, smells right, somebody leans on you and makes you feel right about it or whatever, you can move away from it. That is, the issue really goes down, do we believe that there is anything such more as absolute truth? If we do, then we can believe and uphold the Constitution. If we reject that component, all these things that we're talking about really mean nothing to those who are there. That was one thing I'd like to just mention as in the discussion here. It really comes down to your total value system and whether or not you're a person of integrity. As William Penn said, we can give you the best government, best forum, but unless you put people in office with integrity and character, they will pervert it. And that's what we're talking about right here. Do they have character and integrity?
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, you could follow up with that, too, is what Benjamin Franklin said to Mrs. Powell when the Constitution was passed. She said, what kind of government have you given us? And he says, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. But, Corinne, you have a question.
Yeah, this is a question for any of you gentlemen who want to answer this. So clearly it's become okay to not really know or understand the Constitution that well. How do we change that? What are the first steps to going about changing that?
Oh, I'd love to jump on that one, Corinne.
I think that was planned to lead you right into it.
I tell you, it'll become embarrassing to people to realize just how accessible excellent resources for understanding the Constitution are. If they have access to the Internet, first of all, I would direct them first to www.heritage.org/constitution. The Heritage Foundation has published what is called a Heritage Guide to the Constitution. It's available in print, and I would recommend anybody that is serious about this get a print copy. But it's also, the whole book is available online as well. And they take the entire Constitution, clause by clause, and accompany it with an essay based on an originalist understanding of the Constitution and explain what that clause means. That's the first place to start. And then if you really get enthralled by this, another resource is called the Founders' Constitution. It was a collaboration of the University of Chicago Press and the Liberty Fund, and it's a much larger compendium, but it takes the clause by clause of the Constitution and explains it via the essays and the Federalist Papers and the ratification debates of 1787. Both of those are online and available free of charge to anybody who wants to take the time to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And can I jump in on this too as well?
Please do, Sam.
In addition to that, those are great documents that Gary was talking about there. But I would go and would go one step just a little bit lower, not lower as in inferior, but more foundational even than that. Is that what we do about it, Corinne, you talked about, it's the emphasis on our pastors in the pulpit and the preaching of biblical truth. You see, this republic that we have didn't come out of nowhere. It didn't come out accidentally. It was the result of great theological minds who were understanding, preaching, and teaching the eternal truth of Scripture and the biblical principles that underlie the very concept of authority, government, family, home, and civil government. And out of that is which then came the mentality, coupled together with the history of civilization that had gone before, to take and lay that foundation for what became what we now have. Actually, William Penn, in his frame of government, 1682, which I think had as much to do as anything with out of which came our Constitution, mentioned, I think, 10 principles there that I covered when I was in Ukraine. We're speaking and teaching the pastors in Ukraine just a couple of weeks ago on this. Is that in that document he lays out, he takes and lays out 10 truths, of which include, among other things, understanding the sovereignty of God, that no nation ever rises or falls unless God is there and brings it about. The depravity of man, the fact that that man is inherently selfish and tends to, when put in a position of power, tends to corrupt themselves. Mm-hmm. And in a position of government, tends to centralize power. That whole concept, and I won't go through all of the components, but he mentioned them because those are the principles that must be taught. The basic understanding of the nature of man, the nature of God, the rule of law, what it is, the purpose of law, the purpose of government. Those things are called out biblically, and they were understood by our founders, out of which then came some of these treatises that were written. But there is no better document, no greater source document than the Word of God and the Bible itself. And unfortunately, in our country, you only have about 30% of pastors totally who believe in the authority of Scripture. So a lot. When I say by that, I mean they may believe that the Bible contains the Word of God. They may believe that it contains good things, but only about 30% of recent polls, Barna polls, would indicate that they actually believe that all of it is accurate. All of it is authoritative, which means they leave the door open to decide what they're going to teach, what they're not going to teach, what they're going to add to it, what they're not going to add to it. That is where it starts. I believe it starts in the pulpit and then it emanates into the congregation. It emanates then into society. And so we actually have a people that have become believing that there is no authority, that there is no God that you really have to answer to, these kinds of things. And out of that have come the mentality that we have right now. So it's good to go back and study the founders. It's fantastic what they reasoned and what they went through, but understand where they took it from. And there's no stronger place to go than that.
Absolutely. Chuck?
Sam, I'm sure you'll jump in on this, but our good friend Peter Lilback, president of Westminster Theological Seminary,
yes,
has done tremendous research, as you well know, over the years, and written several books about our founding fathers and about how they came to their state of mind and how they did the work that they did in those days. And although I don't have the titles of those books in front of me at the moment, if anybody wanted to call in, we certainly could get that for them. But as you well know, Peter is a well-known theologian. He's a well-known historian. He's been on Fox and a number of other, I believe CNN as well, because of his expertise in this area. And this is a local treasure. Peter is a local treasure because he's right here in the Philadelphia area and makes himself available to speak and what have you. But his books are a tremendous insight, tying together what you and Gary have both been saying.
Now, absolutely, Chuck. Chuck, thanks for mentioning that, because there is a treasure trove of information, and you're right, it's sitting right up the road from the studios there.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, you know, one thing I want to hit on, and going along this line that we're discussing here, and Sam, you've mentioned the ministers getting involved, the biblical end of it too. And as we all know, and with myself teaching history, being involved in history for so long, one of the biggest challenges I have is getting young people to relate to the past.
And I think even Bruce to even really care. First and foremost, to care.
Well, you've got that, but even a sales, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory sense, even a salesman has to get that potential customer to buy into the product, to understand the product, to look into that product. And with the Constitution itself, to get those people, and I think back, today being Friday, for example, a couple of years ago I was in Phoenixville. I was standing on a corner across from a place. It was in the evening. Some guy walked up and said, "What are you all talking about?" And I said, "Well, we're talking about the Constitution." And his reply was, "It's Friday. Give it a rest." And he goes stumbling off. But how do we get people interested in this, what some would may think as a boring document, and how it applies to them? How do we motivate? Sam, you addressed that with the ministers being involved, but how do we assist in that to get people to understand and appreciate this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, I mean, if they're the pastors in the pulpit go through the same determination, How much should I save? Yeah. If I enter into anything that appears to be political, people will leave. Well, will they? Some, maybe, but many won't, and you will attract many. What's the point even there of a pastor? It's taking truth and making it applicable to the current issues of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And truth is of a nature that it treats, by principle, every issue, biblically we understand that, it treats every issue of the day, answers the questions of life. Why am I here? Where are we going? What am I doing? What is fulfillment in life? Every young person, every person deals with those fundamental questions. And I think the failure to deal with them and to walk into those from a creative sometimes perspective, but let's face it, the young people out there are wandering today. Are they rejecting truth because they don't want it, or are they rejecting truth because they haven't seen it, they haven't heard it, they haven't seen it demonstrated in their homes, in their churches, in office? I would say that the reason that it appears to be less popular is because they haven't seen it. What they have seen are subversions of truth. They get a heavy dose of deception and rewriting of truth and rewriting of history and rewriting of facts. History, properly presented, is extraordinarily interesting to anybody, if in fact it's not presented as a slanted effort to try and to manipulate a kid's mind. They want that. I have found really that the young people have a desire and an appetite to know. It's just that they're not hearing it.
Sam, I have a question for Corinne, and because I'm running into this all the time with young people, and their attitude towards what's going on in Washington, their attitude towards important issues of the day, such as abortion or gay marriage or any of these other things, is, I don't care. If it doesn't affect me, let them do what they want. Now, Corinne, are you seeing that? Is that something that's coming across with young people today?
Definitely. I think a lot of people want to have their own choices, and they don't want anyone to really tell them, you can do this, you can't do this. They just want to be very independent and into their own life. I think with the big rise of technology, you see that especially, too. You know, it's my world, and everyone else is kind of just living in it. And especially we've brought this up, too, Bruce, about things overseas on our It's a New Day mm-hmm. program. It seems like, especially I think for maybe my generation, it's so far away. You know, it's all the way over across the seas. That's not going to affect me, you know. And coming back to America, even things that are going on in here, you know, if it's not in my little bubble, in my little realm, I think there's a big misconception that it won't affect us, and even though it actually will. And I think older generations have seen that over the years, and I definitely think the younger generation wants their choices, and they want it to be their decision. They don't want people telling them what to do.
And Gary, I was going to say, jump in, Gary. You deal with educating the public with the Constitution. That, please.
Well, yes. The general public believes that there will always be an America, that it will always be a constitutional republic. Well, if they understood just how close we are to losing our constitutional republic, they would be studying the Constitution in every waking moment. The Constitution describes four federal crimes initially. In 1787, there were four federal crimes. Today, there are 4,500 federal crimes. And some authors have written books postulating that everyone violates some federal crime every day just because there's no way to know the extent of 4,500 federal crimes. So we are losing our liberties day by day. And there will come a time when we will lose this republic. Franklin had it head on. A republic, if you can keep it, means that this is not going to be a permanent political construct. We are going to lose this republic unless people get energized.
I definitely agree with that. I think people don't realize how valuable our Constitution is because it's not talked about as much as it should be. So they kind of just see it as something in the past. And I think people really don't understand what would happen if we lost the Constitution, let alone they don't even know that we're close to losing this.
Well,
right?
Counselor, I'll throw it to you on that one.
Gary, I couldn't agree more. And I think what we're seeing is a huge tension between the state and federal government, because when you have 4,500 federal laws and the states have the equivalent of many of those laws, if not all of them, and there's a tension between them, and you can take any subject you want. Do we apply this law or not? And you have Eric Holder saying, I'm not going to enforce the marijuana drug laws, and yet you have a state that does enforce them. You have other states that have legalized it. Well, the sovereignty of the state is being eroded by that type of activity, mm-hmm. whether it's the 4,500 laws or whether it's Eric Holder coming out and saying he's not going to enforce
it. Well, can I jump in real quick, Gary? Chuck, and ask the fact that you were talking about the states being eroded. Could one say that it really began with the enacting of the 17th Amendment that took the appointment of the senators away from the state legislature and made it popular? Therefore, you could end up with one-party rule, which turns into a dictatorship.
Hmm. Bruce, absolutely. And if you'll notice, that amendment was right after the enactment of the Income Tax Act.
Yeah, funny.
And there's a funny coincidence there. And when I was in college, I had written a paper about Woodrow Wilson's foreign policy. And in my research, what I found is that a lot of his foreign policy was based on knowing what was going on in the Congress, in the Senate, and some of the laws that they were passing. And he was deliberately and intentionally focusing that foreign policy based on where he knew the country would be going in the future.
Mm-hmm. Gary?
Well, I think you're dead on. The 17th Amendment is a travesty. In the original Constitution, there was to be a tension between the states and the national government, and that tension was deliberate. The state legislature, the senators were nominated and appointed by their state legislators. The senators were to represent the states and the states' interests in the Senate, and the only reason that the Constitution was ratified was because the states understood that they would have their direct voice in the national government through their senators. Mm-hmm. That was taken away in the 17th Amendment. And now that allows the national government to run roughshod over the states. Right. Their only recourse then is through the process of nullification and interposition.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing you mentioned, nullification, because in future programs, I'd like to get into that because I know Jefferson wrote about nullification as well. But let me get Sam in on this as well, because Sam was a former state legislator. Sam, your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's no question about what's being said. We began first as colonies, and then we were states, and then there was the federal government. The federal government was to be the weaker, to do a very minimal thing for us. And they were not to take and overrule the states. And very clearly, I, when I ran for Senate, I made a big deal about the 17th Amendment because I believe that at the heart of it, being on the state side for 18 years, I saw exactly what it was like to basically have everybody popularly elected by the state going to federal government that now becomes the big daddy on the block. And because they can print money and don't have to actually answer for it, can bribe the states, which is exactly what's happened. So you've had the states without representation on the federal level, but at the same time, I've seen a great move over time with the governors of the states, who today, in my opinion, is probably the single position with the greatest amount of authority and power to push back against the federal government. The states have really walked into being merged with the federal government and have given up their sovereignty by taking federal monies. They have known it. They've known it up front. And when they do it, then you can go, you know, Chuck, you know about it. I mean, there have been lawsuits filed, and basically, it's, you know, in the past there have been rulings on it. Well, you know, the federal government didn't take away anybody's rights in the states. States voluntarily gave it up. When they take the money, they take the strings. And what we need are governors right now at this point in time. Governors of states could stand up and say, we will not take the money, and we will not do what you're telling us to do. Probably, you know, according to your statement earlier, what can be done at this point that to kind of push back, I think that the individual governors within the states perhaps have as much remaining power that has not been given up, that can push back, but they have to be willing to say, we don't need your money, federal government, and therefore we're not obligated to do what you tell us to do and override our state laws.
Well, and
these,
Sam,
this is a big issue.
Yeah, and Sam, you're also talking on the fact that, you know, if somebody just tuned in, they're probably thinking we're talking about a narcotic addiction here. And, you know, the line and the phrase that we use a lot here is that the republic will be in, yeah, and I'll paraphrase, the republic will be in jeopardy when Congress learns it can bribe the people with its own money. And that addiction that comes in, how do you gentlemen think this addiction could be broken?
It requires people of integrity and character. Back to the same thing I talked about earlier. You put people in office who allow their oaths, their duties and their responsibilities under law, under the Constitution, ethically towards the people, knowing they're representatives of the people, power in the people. That's an ethical matter as far as carried out. If they hold to those things, then they will purposely decide, I will not embark or go down this road. That's why Penn said, we have to have self-government for it to work, have to have people who are willing to submit themselves under the authority of the Ten Commandments of God. That eternal law, which is the basis for our law, is the thing that we say, I will not steal, I will not lie, I will not covet. It's as applicable for a person saying, I'm not going to steal my neighbor's property, as someone who is in a position of government saying, I'm not going to steal the taxpayer's money. It's the same thing. It's matters of integrity. And this is where the application comes, which I think makes it very, very applicable to today.
Sam, jumping in on that, the one thing that you mentioned, the states accepting money from the federal government, that is so pervasive and we don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, colleges and universities across this country, there are very few that do not accept federal money.
Mm-hmm.
So they are bound by the federal government as to what they can or cannot do. Hospitals. We've recently seen some hospital closing. There's that governor from, I believe it's North Carolina, that walked to Washington protesting the closing of a hospital, a local hospital, because their funding had been cut off. I have talked to some healthcare professionals who have told me that their patients are being denied care because of the Unaffordable Care Act. So federal money is a very huge controlling factor, and people, as Bruce suggested, are addicted to it.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. The hour went by fast. And way too fast, definitely. But that means folks can tune into us next week, next Friday, at 7 a.m. for We the People, Constitution Matters. And we've been joined by our contributors, and we'll be back with them next week. That's Gary Porter, Sam Rohrer, and Chuck Proctor. And for myself, Bruce Stocking.
And Corinne Lillis.
We'd like to, well, just say have a great weekend. Pick up a copy of the Constitution. You can find it online. Take a look at it. After all, as we say, it's Constitution Matters, but here at WFYL and with the Constitution of the United States, it all comes down to we the people matter. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.